You're listening to the BBS Radio Network, and this is Between Two Worlds with Derek White Sky Cloud, healer, author, shaman, paranormal investigator. Stay tuned. Up next is Between Two Worlds.
Welcome, everyone. This is Derek White Sky Cloud, and you're listening to Between Two Worlds on BBSRadio.com. I'd like to say sorry, folks. It's been a little, very little too late. The BBS Radio has been having technical problems, and they got it pretty well all straightened out. Now, I know very well we're not going to take too much of our time to get someone in, because this is a very special guest of mine, one of my best friends, and he is the curator of the Michif Métis Museum, which is the Michif Culture and Preservation Society of British Columbia, and we got something very, very special to announce this evening. So I want to welcome my good friend, Dale Haggerty. Are you there, my friend?
Tante, how are you, Derek? How are you?
Good, very well. And we started a little bit late here, but I'd like to welcome everybody in, also in the chat rooms, those in BBS Radio chat room as well. Now, we've got a lot of Métis people listening in tonight. So I want to share with everyone, too, like everybody, anybody wants to phone in, call. These are toll-free numbers, not smoke signals, toll-free numbers. And the number for anyone calling in from the U.S. is 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. That's in the U.S. For Canada, it's 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. International callers, 530-876-3222. That's 530-876-3222. Now, to let you all know, I've had Dale Haggerty on my show quite a few times these last couple of years. And I guess, you know, it all started in a dream, because Spirit guided me for some reason. I mentioned to Dale, I said, I had a dream that you will have your own radio show. And Dale sort of hummed and hawed the idea, I'm sure, until it was brought up to our producer, owner of the company, Don Newsom. And Don agreed to have this work. And so for the very first time, we will have our very own Internet Métis radio show on Fridays at 8 o'clock, called Métis Voices Radio, Pacific Standard Time. And our new show host for that radio show will be...
Dale Haggerty. Thank you, Derek. That was a great intro for me. Thanks a lot. And I really... really appreciate this great opportunity, thanking BBS Radio for doing this for us. We've been a people of striving, work in our communities to get our stuff going again, so every opportunity like this comes along is really good for us. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Don.
Don, yes.
Yeah, Don Newsom as well, because it's actually, it was Don and his family that said, you know, and his partners that said, okay, let's do it. Let's give it a shot. I think this is worth it. So actually, we have the very first Internet Aboriginal radio show on BBS Radio. So that's going to be, now this is not just specific just for Métis people. We're going to be talking about Métis culture, Métis history, even cooking. You're going to have guests of all parts of the Métis Nation coming on and being interviewed and talking about all types of programs. What else do you think you would have to share?
We're going to be talking about stories of family life. We have some relatives that live in Alberta. You know, small communities and the names that were there and they've been changed over the years and basically some hunting tips and stuff like this. And we're going to try to focus on talking about our language and some of the words and, you know, and generally in the odd time of what's happening in our political fields and stuff like this, but we really don't want to do a lot of political talking, but we still have to inform the people what's going on and stuff like this. But dancing, recipe sharings, we talk about our veterans and their struggles, and our elders and their struggles, and historical sites that have been just recently discovered. It's like you say, Derek, it's this, there's no smoke signals. Well, in the Métis world, we didn't have smoke signals. All they did was to communicate was to burn the buffalo, and they knew that there was something going on. So
well,
there you go.
Here's some music for folks right now. This is called the Red River Jig. My music.
You betcha.
This is what we Métis did. We actually, we used the fiddle, we used different types of tools, even spoons. I believe that we actually, a lot of times people empty their houses to get all the furniture out and they dance inside their homes if it rained outside, or they, a lot of community actually kept always close together. There was never really, you know, today we always talked about the neighbors always keeping to themselves, but those years back then, there was always community, and they always watched over each other.
Oh, yes, and that's a good point you're talking about, and about musical instruments. They used to make a lot of their own fiddles, or if they had a fiddle that was bought back from Europe or something like that, they would actually crack it open, and they would actually make the sound their own sound of music. They would actually, you know, maybe carve it out a little bit thinner and make the wood a little bit thinner, and then they would glue it back together, and they had their sound. There you go. Wooden spoons. Yes.
Wooden spoons. We went to the metal spoons after, but we had wooden spoons. I mean, my grandfather played the juice harp. And he passed it down to me, and there's a very few of us Métis that actually use juice harps. And so whenever I get the opportunity to be asked to come on stage to play with other fiddlers, I remember I being on stage with Art Bird myself, bless his heart, the man's passed away, but he was one of the most honored men that actually can play a fiddle. And actually that's one of his songs that we played, that had Art Bird's name on it. We've actually had recently the fellow by name, one of the politicians here up in Surrey, South Surrey, Mr. St. Germain, and other people in the committee from MNBC and other communities actually created a new, I came up with the idea, but doing an honorary night or day for Art Bird. And so they held a huge performance for that whole day, and then they decided what I was just told recently last week from the powwow that I was at, that they're deciding to do this a yearly thing. So this is going to be a wonderful thing. It's community starting to come together. I mean,
Art Bird was a well recognized musician, and he had an opportunity. I met one of his friends in Alberta. And he had an opportunity to fiddle for George Jones and
wow.
in his early years, and he turned it down. He said music should be shared, and this was one of his best friends from Alberta that used to play with him quite a bit, and Art Bird lived by the music, and he died by the music. When he had this his passing, he was in an entertainment field of when it happened, and that was at the Aboriginal Awards. And it's a respect that Art Bird needs to be told that, you know, that's the way he would have wanted to go out, if, you know, playing the fiddle like he did. So God bless you, Art Bird, in the spirit world.
Yeah, I remember the time that when he got his award that night at the Aboriginal Awards. That was about 2 years ago, and he had a heart attack that evening, right after the awards. I guess all
yeah.
that some excitement. So
yeah, that was.
Yeah, go ahead.
Before it.
Yeah, he was finally recognized for his hard work. Well, I call it hard work. He just loved the music. He loved entertaining people.
Yes.
I know, because I remember we used to do the Métis events in Vancouver with
yes.
one of the Vancouver Métis associations under that would be Paul Stevenson, and we held at the public library in Vancouver here, and Art Bird and Amy and who was the other fiddler? I forgot his name all of a sudden. My God, he'll
yes.
shoot me. Three of them actually got on stage together and played. And then if I got the opportune chance to join them, I was up on there with the Juice Harp, and we had the teepee up there. We had the Métis Museum display. We had all kinds of food. Bannock was one of the main stable.
that was good. And the kids and stuff like that. That was good stuff.
It's all based for, it's like, again, it's for community. And what I really enjoyed about this, it also invited the community, the Papi people that never did know what a teepee looked like inside. Isn't that fascinating when they want to go inside of a teepee just to experience it?
Yeah.
Or they want
yes.
to experience or meet some new people that are in the community that we actually found out they're even relatives of yours.
Yeah, it's not hard to find a lot of relatives. All us Métis people were all related in one way or the other, sort of thing. So.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
But that was good times. I sort of miss it, but my life has moved me on up into the interior to share the culture up here. So, and that's where I.
You're based out of Avonby, British Columbia. Now, where would that be close to?
Well, we're about 27, maybe 28 kilometers outside of Clearwater in the Wells Gray National Park there in British Columbia, central British Columbia, sort of, and which is approximately, I'd say, about 136 kilometers from Kamloops, Kamloops is the nearest largest town or largest city close to us, and we're about 6.5 hours my time going from Vancouver to home here, and or it's about 7.5 hours to Edmonton, Alberta, so we're pretty central, you know,
so
on the Yellowhead, which is the Yellowhead Highway is very famous for our very trails of from the old days. That's how they...
How many hours would it to go by Red River Cart?
It would have been pretty tough going through Red River Cart country here. They would have used a lot of canoes and portage. They would have did a lot of portage. And... you know, walking with horse packs or mule packs and stuff like this, because it was, you got to remember, you know, the days of those, there wasn't too many roads where they could take the carts, you know. Basically, the carts were basically used from, I'd say, northern Manitoba, southern Manitoba, some of Minnesota, all the way up to right to the Rockies, and that was it. Then they started to pack with horses and canoes, and that's how they found their transportation there.
I want to go into your lineage. I want to go into your history of your family. Now, how is it you are? Where did your originally your family base from the beginning?
Well, I can actually tell you if I'm just going to just dig up something here. My lineager first of all, my mom's maiden name is Villeneuve or Villeneuve, which they would have said it in them days, Villeneuve. And of course, how it starts here, well, I have my family tree here, and as far as I've gone back, it's gone back as far as 1635, I guess. And it was Pierre Letendre Diet Liberté. And then, of course, it's the Pierre Letendre families. I have the Vandals, James Hughes, Charlotte Hughes, Joseph Premieu, John Stevenson. I have Emmanuel Beauregard Diet Champan, and I actually have some very famous people in here, like Louis Letendre Diet Batoche, which is the actual last resistance of the Métis. In my tree. The Henrys in my tree. And of course, I have also the Villeneuves, the Valleys. And, I have Alexandra Henry is one of the notable, famous persons in his diary. He was an explorer as well. He was an entrepreneur. And what he did was, in his diaries, he wrote in his diaries that he saw over 300 or 400 Red River carts leaving Manitoba to the Saskatchewan hunting fields for buffalo, for their pemmican, to making their pemmican and bringing back their meats and stuff like that. So it's actually in the history of the diary in Alexander Henry's book. So that was a very famous person in our family. And, of course, we have Joseph Vandal, which he actually was killed at the Battle of Batoche. He died later of his wounds after the battle. He was after the resistance was over, he actually was bayoneted about 4 or 5 times, and, of course, later on died of his wounds.
Of course that would be wounds.
Yeah.
Those are deep wounds.
Yeah, they were quite a story about how after the resistance was over and the white flags went up, the soldiers were still going after them and trying to totally eliminate them. So,
also, like the Red River cart, I mean, we talked about that a couple of years ago, you and I. We remember you were talking about that even one of your great uncle, he was also one of the people that was responsible for bringing the Red River cart across from the eastern part of Canada, from Upper Canada down to Lower Canada.
Yes, yeah. That was actually part of the Henry expedition, I guess.
Yeah.
He was part of that you know, he was
what,
part of that.
The people that were for making it, or was that someone else?
No. Actually, the making of it was somebody else. I'm not too sure. What they did was they got the idea. The carts were always a European thing, from France and England, of course, from the carts, and of course, the difference between our Red River cart was the wheel size. And the reason why we have a 13-spoke wheel, and what it was it was larger than the cart box itself. And the reason why is because they were going through lots of creeks, and as a larger wheel, it would have been less. It would have taken less of a bump, sort of thing, and that's why the wheels was. That was a design by the Métis people of the Red River. They had to do that in order to cross the prairies, because there was lots of shallow creeks and rivers. That was, you got to remember, there, this is untouched land. There was no farms, there was no roads. They made their own roads and stuff like this. And the nicest part about this is they also took that not one nail was used. It was all put together by pegs and pins, wooden pins that they would make to make these wheels and make everything. So they made it so that they could actually take the wheels off and put hide in there, smoked hide, and actually tie them to the bottom of the Red River cart and float these things across creeks that were too large, or rivers, and they could cross by sending the animal across. Then they would get a rope, and they could pull these things right across the creeks and everything. It's an amazing story that, you know, what do you do when you come to a creek? You don't go around it. They went right through it, and they just knew what to do. It's amazing, you know. And to this day, there is still Red River cart roads that are still, they just discovered in Saskatchewan that there's on top of mounds the actual tracks of the actual tracking of the Red River wheels that were dug into the dirt. It was still today, and that's 100 and probably 175 years later, and these, like the Carlton Trails and stuff like that, they're still out there, unbelievable. You look in the farms in some of the northern parts. Yeah, it's totally amazing that these things are today. I have to admit, you know, they were the first transportation that was to cross Canada, and of course, hey, it was Métis people that did this, and you know, and I'm so proud of them, you know, that they could. You know, they could have a trucking company sort of thing do it nowadays, but they used the Red River carts to do all that. They used to supply the forts and bring them all the supplies, and then, of course, then on the way back, they would bring the furs back to the east and use them for trading and ship them back to England or France, wherever the furs were going. So
I
yeah,
remember when they were... with the cart as well, that it can carry as much as 1,000 pounds.
They said they actually found a cart, and they put it back together the way they figured it, and they figured it was about 2 tons that it could carry. That it was actually, they actually sat 2 tons in the actual box with a horse, and they actually pulled it for about 15, 20 feet. Yes, there was quite a bit of weight, you know.
And one about having a cart, too, was actually when they could take the wheels off, you could tie them down underneath, and you could float them down the river like another small riverboat.
Oh, and yeah. A lot of the Saskatchewan and Manitoba lakes were very shallow, so, you know, it was... And the funny thing about this is the way the wheel is has a concave to it. So it's like a little dish. So it was like a boat bottom. Honestly, that's what it looked like. So, and yeah, you're right. That's what they did. You know, so it was a real amazing feat for these people to do this.
Are there any Métis carts ape now, or?
Sorry?
Is anyone out there actually designing the cart? They're still keeping that history going?
Well, I think they still, in Manitoba, there's a group of Métis men are still making the wheels today. What they do is if an organization needs to make a cart, you know, and they just can't figure out how to make the wheels, there is an organization in Manitoba that, from what I've understood, that you could actually buy the wheels from, and they would ship them anywhere you want. You just make your own box, and apparently there is still plans that you could actually get from the Canadian archives of how to make a Red River cart, actually a full-scale drawings of how to make it, you know, so it gives you the sizes and stuff. But you got to remember, every Métis were individuals, so every cart was made
to
suit themselves, right?
Yeah.
You know, they could be large for transporting things, it could be just for transporting the family. You know, there was a story about it, and this is, you know, in the 30s that, my grandfather said, my mom was telling us that she remembers hearing a story about how her great-grandfather or her grandfather, which was my great-grandfather, said that they used to go into town and have a few drinks and beer and stuff like this. And of course, if they got too loaded, they would just put them on top of the Red River cart with the horse, and the horse would take them home. And so it was amazing that you could hear the squeak. As long as you could hear the squeak into the wheels, you knew he was okay, sort of thing. So there you go. There's a little story for you. And
we
it's probably not the only family that's done it either. So, there you go.
Some of the families, a lot of the Métis were also famous for their history of the sash.
Oh, yeah.
I've had, myself doing the powwows, a lot of people ask me each time we have a different color sash that are, you know, we are displaying to sell, or even ones that are on display in the museum, and each of them are asking, what does each color mean, or where do they come from, or what area does it purpose of the sash? What do you understand the sash means to you?
Well, I'm like I think we discussed this once before, Derek. I'm a person that thinks of, you know, supply and demand. I think they had a design that they all used as. As far as the color's concerned, I think it was up to the individual, and it was also a supply and demand, because, like, every little area, you know, if you didn't get, let's say, for example, you needed, just for an example, you needed two balls of each color to do your sash. And all of a sudden, there wasn't that color available because, you know, Mrs. Smith came in and she bought the other two balls of wool that you needed. So they just chose another color, all right? So, or they didn't get their supplies, you know, enough of it was sent from one fort to the other fort. So, you know, that's the way I thought. But they had their arrow designed and their lightning designs, and I believe, you know, I know there's a story of the Assumption Sash, and it was adopted. You know, I think, you know, basically, I think it was, they got the idea from our First Nation brothers and you know, because they were using it, but we had access to the wool. So the Assumption Sash was probably adopted by them, but that's where, you know, then they started to make them by machines and stuff like this. But as an individual, most of the individuals, if you find a sash that is hand-woven, that is 200 years old, you have got an heirloom that is priceless, because that person doesn't probably live in, he's in the spirit world right now. So, you know, that is a very nice artifact to have. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I noticed that a lot of the sashes are actually that are very old, or actually rare, so to speak. They just found one recently that was apparently owned, worn by Louis Riel, who was one of our famous historian forefathers of the Métis. And apparently there's a lady, I believe from Kamloops or Kelowna, that had this sash, and she passed it on to the Métis Association in Manitoba, which now it's in their museum. And apparently this sash, I believe, is around 200 years old.
Yeah, well, like I said, the Assumption Sash was probably, you know, it doesn't take much, 1801, you know, and that's 200 years, you know what I'm saying? So, and you got to remember now, Louis Riel was from Quebec, right? You know, he was French, right? You know, French Métis, so he had the access to these sashes. And if it, like I says, if it's a hand-woven sash, I mean, that it's priceless. It's like the Mona Lisa of paintings. It's these are the things that you can't replace. Machines now, they're reproducing things, so, but it's a beautiful thing when you can find a hand-woven sash, right? You know,
definitely.
So, yeah, there's actually, this cousin of ours, her name's Senator Shalafu. She runs the museum in St. Albert's, and it's called the Machif Cultural Métis Resource Institution, and it's in St. Albert's, and a sash. His name was Joseph Dion, and it's a grandfather of one of my elders, and it was handmade sash, and it is laying there looking at me, going, "Boy, you are just one beautiful looking sash." It was just. Fabulous to have this kind of collection there for her. So,
at Teresa yeah. Dion's, that's our elder, the elder Teresa Dion. Is that her family sash?
That's her. Yeah, that was her grandfather. Yeah, they were. Teresa was brought up in that area, in Lac Ste. Anne and Gunn, Alberta area. And matter of fact. When we get our radio program, I am going to be talking about small communities in Alberta, northern Alberta, southern Alberta, and all these little areas that people are living right now and have discovered things, discovered heritage things that they didn't realize that were, and they were already established. Like I have the privilege of my mom's maiden name is Villeneuve, and of course there's a little community called Villeneuve in Alberta, and of course we've got some of the history, and of course it all relates to our great grandfathers. Mine was Isidore, and Senator Shalafu was severe Villeneuve, and of course it all is where they were, Fort Edmonton and all that area. So that's where it all started for me and my ancestors, but only my ancestors moved on to the Red River and got married in Red River and eventually ended up in Batoche. And the grandfather, Isidore Villeneuve, was there when the Manitoba province was first came into Confederation. They were part of that, the group of Louis Riel's resistance to taking over and standing up for their rights. And eventually, you know, they all were being fed up because, you know, they would go on their hunts and get their meats, and then they would come back and their homes would be occupied. So eventually Gabriel Dumont and a few other people, the Vandals, they all eventually found a better area, and of course they even called it the St. Laurent Settlement in Saskatchewan, northern Saskatchewan. And eventually, you know, Deet Batoche was created, the town of Batoche was created, and of course a lot of the families from the Red River slowly moved up into that area, getting away from the political end of the stuff that was going on, and the lies and the threats and all the stuff that was going on. So they all moved up to Manitoba and northern Saskatchewan, and they tried to, and they did it all over again. You know, they started a resistance up there, and, you know, eventually that's the one they didn't succeed in. And but, yeah, that's, and eventually a lot of them were escaped from the tyranny of the soldiers after the resistance was over. Like Louis Riel gave himself up. They say, oh, they caught Louis Riel. No, that's not true. There was a conference just after the battle or the resistance had just ended, and Gabriel was trying to convince Louis to go with him to Montana. A matter of fact, there was a group of families that were already on their way to Montana, but Louis said, if I run, then that doesn't make sense for the people. So he turned himself in and he says, I'm going to fight this, because he was sort of like a lawyer at the time. Unfortunately, they call it a fixed trial sort of thing, and he didn't succeed. Of course, then they hung him for treason. And so my family had happened to, one of the families had escaped, and that was the Villeneuve's, and because he was one of Gabriel Dumont's captains of the chute sort of thing. So their family had just moved on. And I'm not too sure, because we've lost a little bit of history of what really happened, but we, from what I'm gathering now and more, that they all went as far as, got as far as Montana and, or North Dakota and North, and then they, some of the families turned back and headed back up to northern Saskatchewan. And eventually my family, the Villeneuve family, ended up in Fish Creek, Saskatchewan, of course. And of course, when they came in, they just looked like, well, we were just a new family sort of thing. They didn't really know what was going on. So there you go.
Have you put your new sign up yet on your property called Hagertyville?
No. Oh, yeah, there's a little joke going on around here yet, so, no, we're okay. Yeah, we're okay. We've got our piece of We've got our piece of property. You know, there's an old saying that there's a movie that George Clooney was in, and the three prisoners, or they were all three prisoners, and he says, "What were you going to do with your $1 million?" He says, "I'm going to buy my farm back." He says, "You're nobody without a piece of land," and that really stuck to me. So that's it's a piece of land that makes you really feel good about yourself. So we've got our little piece of heaven up here, so we're okay.
Now I'm going to ask you a question here too. Another question is that even though we have, I mean, we're getting close to closing on the show, but the Métis Voices Radio, when you have your guests on, is this going to be open lines?
Yes, it's what everybody wants to talk about is it's going to be fine with me. I don't want to make it so we're slamming people because this isn't the place for it. This is a very cultural. We can talk about our politics and stuff like this, but I don't want names slinging out there and calling names bad people this and whatever. And so, I'm not, and I'll be really honest with you. We're having problems with our political system, and we're doing the best we can. We know we need this political system. But people do make mistakes, and we got to live through the good times and the bad times, right? So, some of our politicians aren't. They sometimes need a reality check, but that's what we have our elders there for. So they can, our elders can sort of take care of them and straighten them out and make sure that they're on the right track. So, for our younger people.
Anyways, folks. I'm sorry? Go ahead, Dale.
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Derek.
I was going to say, let everybody know that not this Friday, but on the 18th of April is going to be the very first show, Métis Voices Radio.
Yes.
And it's going to be one-of-a-kind radio show. I mean, there has been other radio shows on other programs, but this is a little bit more unique because this is based out of the Machif Métis Museum.
Yes.
Which, again,
yes. We've got
Dale,
sort of like...
It's fabulous.
Yeah, we've got sort of like a little museum set up here for the people that want to come by and visit us, too. I'm laughing to myself because, my wife says, don't get me started talking. So I'm hoping... I'm hoping, Derek, that you're going to be on my first guest show, and you're going to be doing most of the talking instead of me. So I love talking about our history and culture and stuff, but I'm going to try to let our guests do the talking and let them hear some other stories that have been going on, because it is a fascinating world that us Métis people we're here. We made North America, you know what I'm saying? And I have to say it across the United States because, they were not called Métis people in the United States, but the half-breeds, and they were the ones that were translating with our First Nation brothers across the lines, and they were the scouts, and they were the ones that were discovering the lands before Clark and Henry and all these Alexandra and Thompson and Fraser, they already had done this stuff already. You know what I'm saying? Because, they were making a living at it, So I, for even us, our brothers across the line, we got to praise that our Métis people or half-breed people, made this country what it is, so... I'm very proud to talk about it all the time, but I'm going to try to let guests talk instead.
Yeah,
that
never know, Dale. You know. I've been doing
Never get me started. It's a lot of fun. It's like those two gentlemen that talk on ghost trails and stuff like that. That they just have a fabulous time talking about real history, because it really is the way we were. It's the way it's the way it was. And it's good to hear stuff like that.
Well,
there you go.
Anyways, it's been getting close to closing, so basically to let everybody know that we're getting close to that time now. And I'd like to thank Dale Haggerty for coming on. And I'm looking forward to talking to Dale one and a half weeks on the 18th. I'm going to be his guest. So we're going to have a lot of fun. So, folks, to let you all know, we'll talk to you next week.
Derek, it's Friday coming up.
What's that?
It's this Friday.
Oh, is it this Friday? Is it
you
Friday?
Betcha. You betcha.
Okay, so
I
take it back, guys. That's this Friday. See, I'm 1 week behind. I've been traveling so much. It's this Friday.
Oh.
Dale Haggerty is coming on. Be there, or be Métis.
Thank you, Derek, and thanks, everybody, for listening to the program.
Have a great night.
Sunset Bay.
Take care. We'll talk to you then, folks. Talk next week. Bye.
Merci.
Bye.